it's our money that is shaping the future of capitalism. And we can choose, unfortunately, again, made really hard to choose, but we can exercise discretion about which pension funds we join. We can choose to join a high impact pension. We can choose to divest and pull all of our money out of fossil fuels. We can choose to invest in the businesses that have our, that share our values. If you look at most pension funds, like you would be mortified to find out what, you know, most people who are auto-enrolled, they're in the default pension. If you look at what it's invested in, if you can even find out what it's invested in, you're doing well. But then you review it and it's like, woof, that's not cool. I did not want to be invested in weapons and oil and massive banks. I want to be invested in world-saving biotech and renewable engineering. I want to be invested in the stuff that's going to do a hockey stick curve in the next 10 years because that's what we need.
That's Ed Dowding. Up next on the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is a show all about uncertainty and risk. And I started it a couple of years ago to better understand and benefit from these things across all aspects of life and to share these insights and these conversations I have with all of you. This next one is pretty thought-provoking, and I also think it's a perfect time to release this episode, because as I'm doing this intro, which I'm recording in my flat in London, the UK is just a week and a half away from crashing out of the European Union without a deal, which would be economically quite catastrophic. If you are in the UK, regardless of whether or not you voted to leave or remain, or if you are outside this country and you're looking at all of this with some bewilderment, and regardless of what happens here over the next couple of weeks, I have a prediction. And that prediction, I think I can say fairly confidently, is this. Politics here is and will continue to be a shit show. And wherever you are in the world, I think you can say the same thing about a lot of what's going on in your country. And again, that's regardless of your political affiliation. We have divisiveness, self-interest on the part of politicians and leaders, corruption, and to be honest, political institutions that just have not kept pace with technological and societal change. And I think that's tragic because democracy is worth fighting for. So with that backdrop, let me introduce our guest to you, because he's someone who's looked at these things for many years before the collective omni-shambles we seem to find ourselves in around the world. His name is Ed Dowding. He's a social entrepreneur whose mission has been to look for better ways to make good things happen in the world. He's founded businesses in democracy and public decision-making, as well as in sustainable food. Ed, I think, is a man before his time. But I also think that his time just might be coming. We talk about all of those things in what I think is a really great and very necessary conversation. And what I particularly liked about this conversation, as you'll hear from Ed's experiences in sustainable food and in founding what is this amazing idea for a social enterprise, this company called Represent.me, which is based on a concept called liquid democracy, which we get into. All of those experiences have brought out the constraints our society is up against in terms of overcoming the mayhem we are encountering in our politics, our governance, our economy, our society. And I think Ed is someone who really was at the coalface of all of that well before everything that we are experiencing has come to the fore and has bubbled up. And we get into all of that. And lots more. We talk about things like minimalism. We spend a good chunk of time talking about food and agriculture. Obviously, we get into democracy. We talk about entrepreneurship. Ed is a very insightful person. He's extremely innovative. And we need more people like him in this world. So let's dive in. Here is Ed Dowding. Ed, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
It's going to be fun because I tend to have two types of conversations. Mm-hmm. So one type of conversation is all about big picture risks. So the role of democracy in the world, climate change, transhumanism, AI, that sort of stuff. You know, some of the biggest risks and uncertainties of our times and society.
I enjoy those ones.
Yeah, so do I. I love those. And at the same time, I tend to have conversations with people who take risks in their businesses or in their lives, adventures. And I think we're going to touch on both a little bit here.
Okay. Yeah, so, I imagine we will.
Yeah. So before we get into all that, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background and who you are and what it is that you do.
My background, I'm one of these people who just sort of dives in to things. So my background, my journey is slightly circuitous.
Those are the best people to talk to.
Good.
I seek out people like that because you probably have some wonderful detours that you've taken along the
and
way
you
that,
learn an awful lot of things from a lot of different sectors. It's more like you know, every now and again when I feel like, oh god, I'm just being a dilettante and drifting around, then actually it's very useful to pollinate ideas between sectors and be that person that synthesizes ideas between domains and thinks, horrible hackneyed phrase, but outside the box for things, and can bring fresh thinking to a domain by thinking about it differently. So that's often been my approach, largely by default rather than design or choice. But I did school, went to a lovely school down in Dorset, it was great. Possibly to a certain extent wasted on me. You don't really appreciate things quite as much as when you're growing up because it's normal. And then you go back there and it's, wow, this place is amazing. and went up to university in Edinburgh. I left after my first term because it just seemed like it was going to be a bit of a waste of time, essentially.
What did you study?
Psychology, criminology, and artificial intelligence. Yeah. I mean, I didn't study those things because I wasn't there, but that's what I was supposed to be studying. But it largely, interestingly, seemed like it was going to be a bit of a sort of devalued experience. Like it was this process, this sort of sheep dip that vaguely intellectual people had to go through before you were allowed out in the real world. And then you had this bit of paper that you could wave and it entitled you to higher salaries and things. And it just seemed like the people in the room weren't actually excited about the process of learning and curious. And I think, you know, had I done a different course, had I been to a different university, you know, I know lots of people who went there, friends. You know, I basically lived like a student for 4 years, but was working. And so, great experience. I would strongly recommend it. But I would also not make anyone, I think if you choose not to do it, that's probably also a good thing. Don't be frightened of taking that decision just because it's not the norm. I think you'll possibly have a much more interesting life if you don't. But, you know.
What did you aspire to be when you were growing up? What types of things did you...
Do you know what? I either have no idea or didn't or have forgotten. Like, I don't think I did, really. I had a certain set of values and enjoyed thinking about things and enjoyed thinking about systems and how to improve things. And my dad was one of these people who asked, you know, how could you make that better? And that, how do you build a better mousetrap? It was one of his sort of tropes of, and that sort of idea of the improvability of things is, I guess, a perennial theme in my life. The other thing, I always liked geography and the sort of systemic approach and the integrated approach of geography and its desire to actively look for patterns and extrapolate data into patterns, form theories, test those theories, and then improve upon those theories. You know, so how do we get better at locating industry, getting energy out of something, building functional communities and making sure our towns are, you know, healthy, sustainable, viable, pleasant places to live. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, and geography does that. And that I've always enjoyed that way of thinking. So I then found myself sort of out in the world without a degree. And I'd always enjoyed making films. I used to make little like videos and things and edit them with two VHS machines. And, you know, and so went off and I wanted something where I could accelerate quite quickly and, you know, progress my career for what it was quite quickly. And so I started making ads and adverts and commercials and short films, feature films, TV programs, that sort of stuff. And quickly set up a production company, because as soon as you know, you start as a runner, someone realizes he can easily do that, and then you become a production assistant, and then you become a production manager and locations and production, yeah, etc. And it goes, and it's a really fun world to work in. But then the internet came along, and people started saying, oh, can you put that on a CD-ROM and can you make that interactive? And and then can you turn that into a viral email? And can you track who's viewing it? And can you capture their email addresses? And can you get us data about them? And can you make that interactive? Okay, this internet thing is going to be bigger, more exciting, more
like... How long ago was this?
2001? Mm-hmm. 2000? Sure. 2001? I mean, I had one of the first digital sort of... prosumer, I guess, digital edit suites for the films that we were making. It was that, you know, SD cards were still, you know, max 128 meg, that sort of thing. Things were being recorded to tape, not cards at all. So it's, yeah, like early days. And so it was, you know, the location agnostic, the being able to build things really incredibly quickly and reach a lot of people quickly. It's like, oh, this is going to be a better place to push to try and make things happen. This internet thing is going to be more exciting. And then so just started saying yes to people who had internet projects, and then knowing that, you know, well, if it can be done, I can probably work it out. I'm young and self-confident. and if I can't work it out, I can find other people who can, and I can just charge a little bit more than they do and just sell it on and manage the project. You know, let's just go and do interesting stuff. And that one of my first projects was in risk, risk analysis project, a company called Exclusive Analysis.
Oh yeah, I know them.
Yeah. Do you know Simon?
No, okay. I've never met, never.
He probably exited before you.
Him.
Yeah. Mm. So, I was like second, third person working with him, and he had this spreadsheet, and he's like, can you make this box go this color and conditional formatting and stuff? I'm like, yeah, we could do that, Simon, or let me tell you about this web thing. and sort of outlined a plan for him of how we could take data from, you know, 16,000 data sources around the world, take headlines and geolocate those headlines from keywords in the title and look for other keywords like gas, explosion, death, oil, hospital, you know, whatever. And essentially do a big data exercise. This is before big data was coined as a big
like
data.
Little
thing.
Big data or pre-big data.
Pre-big something. Data, yeah. Mm-hmm. Or I guess big data existed, but no one really called it big data. And we weren't doing data mining. Well, we were doing data mining, but we didn't call it that. And it was just like really hard and annoying maths with crazy algorithms. And so we created this web platform. This was like 2003, four, possibly five, probably three, four. And that did all this, made all these beautiful, colorful maps. We had to build our own map servers because this was before Google Maps existed, of course. And
so just for listeners who are trying to picture what this is all about. So as far as I understand that firm, these are sort of maps based on political risk or security risk or things like that. That kind of say, oh, this country in Africa is bright red because of some of the politics or the civil war or whatever.
Exactly. And so it was the client was the insurance underwriters. And they would, you know, someone would come to them with a risk and they would, like, I have no idea where that place is in Colombia, but if you want a pipeline there, I'm sure I can find a price that I'll insure it for. And then they needed to go and look in Colombia and find out why it was dangerous, who it was dangerous to, because, you know, obviously an American oil pipeline has a very different risk profile from a UN-backed hospital or, you know, malaria program or something. It would give them more information upon which to base their decision and thus work out what to underwrite it for. And so that was really cool and fun. And then went off after that and did started working for another startup that wanted to do emergency communications for the police. For the Met Police, so that they could basically draw on a map and send a message to security guards within a specific area to help them in a policing task. So, hey, this child's gone missing. Boom. Where are they? You know, keep your eyes open. Or, hey, we've got a suspect package here. It's almost lunchtime. Can you send people away from here when they come out of your building? And so you engage people that way and everything goes a lot smoother. That was cool. And we actually launched on 7/7, a couple of months prematurely. But we launched because basically all of the other communication systems failed. And so ours was the only one. We had the joy that not actually that many people knew about it, so it wasn't massively stress tested, but it was still like, huh, cool, there we are, done. But after another year and a bit of doing that, it sort of realized that partly through the economics of it were really challenging, and it was sort of public-private partnership time and massively underfunded projects going on. You'd be terrified if you knew some of the numbers that were involved in these sort of important things. It sort of dawned on me that we weren't really solving important problems. And you know, a certain amount of risk in society is healthy. Right. And we would, if we went much further, we were sort of going to start getting in the way of people who were doing their jobs really well, like the, you know, the emergency services. We were going to start getting in their way more, because one way or another we were facilitating top-down interference, and that's not what they wanted. And the people on the ground wanted information, but not interference. And anyway, so there's various bits of politics and sort of, I'm not sure that's the best way to solve the problem.
Okay. So you're working in a space where you're one of the sort of pioneers looking at data and what it could tell us, but the questions that were being answered weren't really that compelling.
So by this time, it had become an emergency management platform for London. And with that, you've got sort of two choices of that. Do you empower the people on the ground to take better, more informed decisions and just give them information and rely on hive mind intelligence?
Right.
Or do you give them command and control decisions, command and control orders, I guess, which
based on certain rules or
based on, you know, so someone in a control booth somewhere with a, to be fair, probably, you know, an incredibly good oversight of the system, but they possibly don't have the same degree of insight to what's happening on the ground as the person on the ground does. And so it was, but one way or another, you know, we're not talking about major incidents very often. And so we, from my perspective as a kind of, you know, tens of thousands of people die every day from some really basic simple stuff that we could stop right now. And if we fix that, actually we would probably get fewer terrorists coming over and trying to do stuff in the first place. So should we go and focus on those problems instead and fix those and make the world better for large numbers of people? It's slightly sort of utilitarian argument, but you know, it doesn't make it any less valid. And so started looking at, okay, so how do we fix the problems that we need to fix on our watch? What is our responsibility before we die? What should we improve systemically, ideally, just because that's how I like to think, that makes a cascading and enduring difference to how things work? And it seemed that this is a very long background question.
We're touching on some really good stuff that we'll get into.
I sort of basically went into a bit of an existential crisis for a while and just read lots and got very sad about the way things are in the world. But looking at, so and sort of brought these problems down to the things that it struck me that were massively dysfunctional and going to be catastrophic if we didn't fix them were politics, political systems, and how we do that. And we'll come on to this, I guess. Money. How we think about it, what it is, what it represents, and can we make it actually encode value as opposed to just numbers? Can we make, can we give it a moral direction and give it some sort of physical constraints such that it helps us live sustainably within one planet, that sort of stuff? Time, how we think about work hours, you know, the 40-hour work week, and why are we doing that, and what happened to that promise of the leisure society that we chopped down all those forests and dug up all that coal for?
John Maynard Keynes at one point said we will be working 15-hour work weeks.
Never
happened.
And it hasn't happened, not only to our detriment, but to an ecological detriment.
And the amount of time that we spend thinking about work outside of working hours, particularly knowledge jobs, is extraordinary.
So that's an undelivered promise that we should be delivering on. And our failure to tackle that one and our failure to update the economic model that drives and perpetuates that one as well is just leading us to individual, social, and environmental burnout or burn up. And that's not cool. And so that's, we should probably fix that one. And then energy was the fourth thing. So money, time, politics, and energy. So the shift to renewable or nuclear, you know, safe nuclear. And looking at those. And then
so you're getting all concerned about these kinds of things, and here you are doing algorithms for tactical little...
Actually, no, I'm more sort of...
operational problems.
I'm in my sort of, you know... screw it, I quit university and go and work out what to do. I actually quit that job and then went and had my existential breakdown or breakdown of the systems. And so I'm not very smart like that. Doing what you said would have been much, much wiser. But I sort of reached this point of frustration where it's just like, no, I'm going and went. And
did you just quit the job without a clearly defined... next step.
Yeah, I had no idea what I was going to do next. But it's that, you know, to a certain extent, there's the necessity is the mother of invention thing. And
I think sometimes we live in a society that values comfort, and because we have this level of comfort, it makes it very easy to not challenge ourselves or try and solve our, you know, some of our deepest problems or society's deepest problems, or even just have a little bit more meaning.
Yes.
Because, you know, Netflix is on and, you know, we can order food and we can order anything from Amazon. And, you know,
I was having a chat with a friend today who was saying that she much prefers living in basically cold, rundown houses where the heating doesn't work, and there's not an endless supply of hot water, because it forces her to be active. It forces her to get out and do things, and otherwise, you become complacent. And
there's also this countervailing trend of minimalism, particularly amongst millennials. And I was thinking about this, and also talking about this with some of my co-startupees just yesterday. And there is a countervailing trend towards these things, because I think it helps us attached to life, to how food is made, to how a little bit of struggle also gives us a little bit more meaning. And I think that's wonderful.
And an appreciation of hard work and the hard work that others do as well. And what I think I like, although this is possibly anecdotal, is this sort of new minimalism seems to be, there was the turn on, tune in, drop out sort of minimalism of the 70s. Let's go off grid and low energy, and essentially low energy all around, low energy in, low energy out. Whereas it seems to be this neo-minimalism is low energy consumption, maximum effect output. And there is a concern, I think, for certainly a significant number of those people to try and create multipliers of impact and cascade their vision, their approach out into the world. So it's not about let's eat lentils. It's about let's create a regenerative polyphase agriculture that creates a more abundant food and ecosystem, such that we have more prosperity, more food, more flourishing, more healthy soils, more water retention, etc., etc. And so, yes, it's that,
and it's the use of technology in a positive way as well. I don't see a lot of these people as sort of Luddites. They're all over social media, using social media, and we can get into social media perhaps in a moment.
Yeah, and then
using technology.
Using it within watering systems, using it to monitor crops, even to harvest and check on crops, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's fantastic. So I suppose it just comes from a consciousness of one's own footprint and that idea of treading lightly on the world. And that's nice. And realizing that actually you don't have to sacrifice that much in order to accomplish that. And through that sacrifice comes greater gains. Both for yourself and for others. So, yeah. Interestingly, sort of segueing into agriculture as we did then, it sort of dawned on me that with this politics, money, time, and energy sort of quadrant of challenges, that food and agriculture was one that was implicitly interwoven into all of these things. So, food is our largest use of fresh water. It's our biggest cause of premature death. It's the world's largest employer. You know, if you include self-employed, I've forgotten the term, self-sufficient farmers.
Subsistence
farming. Yep. Thank you. And so this, and plus also it's a culture that in theory self-defines as being very adaptive and responsive. And so, in theory, again, quickly adopts new techniques and practices. And so if you can get, a whole bunch of farmers to change how they plow a field, you can totally change the ecology of that microclimate. And if you can multiply that, you change the ecology of a region or a state or a country. And the ability to do things like draw down carbon into the soils, because carbon and soils are fantastic for storing carbon. So, and if you, on the financial side and the employment side, if you relocalize supply chains and help people source more locally, it does that. So you get something called the local economic multiplier. So the velocity of money in the local area increases. So more people spend more money locally, and therefore more people are employed, and more people can live in our rural areas. And I think counter-urbanization is a desirable thing, because the risk in cities, back to the risk thing, cities are massively vulnerable, and that's possibly going to be a bad thing for humanity. And by decreasing the inequality between cities and the countryside,
cities are massively vulnerable, I don't know the statistics are, but if you look at the Yellow Jacket, the Gilets Jaunes movement in France, and a lot of those people are not from the major urban centers, but they feel neglected.
Yeah.
They're from, I guess, the sort of middle France, or I'm not sure what you would call that, but communities that are not served by public transport, and they see the current government as not really caring about their sort of situation. So the inequality and the divisiveness,
and of course, not just France, UK as well.
Yes,
we've totally screwed over our regions. Mm. Yeah, and our countryside, and to no benefit whatsoever. And there are lots of people who are, I believe, very rightfully angry about this level of neglect, because it doesn't take much to make these areas flourish. Yeah. And we're denying them even that, and through the sort of some very strange ideas about resource allocation. And so So if you can help those communities help themselves, relocalize supply chains, improve attention being paid to the food and food agriculture system, you improve practices, you know, if it's local, it's more likely, if you've already started paying attention, you're more likely to go organic or at least free range, or one way or another, start paying more attention to the standards because you want to write it up proudly on your pub blackboard and also find a way of charging £2 or £3 more for it, right? And if it's like Jack from over the hill provided us with that lamb that you're eating right now, it's a nice story that people like. And so I basically set up a business in trying to map the supply chain between various different businesses to introduce more transparency and create a sort of, to a certain extent, an online marketplace, but certainly an online search engine that showed who's got what where and who wants what where, product-wise. And so you could then say, you know, where did you source these from? And or print out a little map that goes in the back of your menu and it's got all of your suppliers and then little personal stories dotted out on it and shows what produce you get from which place. And similarly, if you're if you want to find apples for your village shop locally, you can just type in apples in your postcode, boom, and that's where you can get them from. And it's got these sort of cascading benefits where you can then start to have new entrants come in and optimize the supply chains because who's delivering what where is visible. So if you've got like parallel journeys, you can approach those people, those stakeholders, and say, yeah, let me do this for you. I'll do it half the price, etc. So we'll create more collaboration, more opportunities. And it's just that if we put lots of open data out there, make it really easy to use, let's see what happens. And so that was fun. Did that for a couple of years, but really hard. Really hard to get.
Well, I was going to say, number one, I suppose you need people, consumers, that are interested in knowing this stuff. And that's tough because you can just go online and get your apples from Sainsbury's or whatever and get them delivered, and they maybe come from South Africa or something like that, and they're really cheap. Your chickens are, you know, £2 for a chicken, you know, whatever. Yeah. All of this, it's just the convenience culture once again that you're fighting against it.
Quite spot on. And very few people have an incentive to fix the problem.
Well, in fact, there's a disincentive because incomes are under strain, and so it's just a lot easier to feed your family with stuff that's sourced from God knows where, produced however maybe.
I would actually just sort of point of information. Yes, it is if you're time pressured, but if you're not, it's actually easier and cheaper to, you know, buy in bulk, buy from the right local shops and get your deals. Hell, even if you don't do sustainable sourcing, just being able to buy it, take the time to find somewhere where you can buy a sack of potatoes will massively cut your costs, and so on and so on. So it's hard. It's a lot harder than doing what the industry, what the market wants you to do, because that's how the market makes most money, but it's not impossible. And the other thing that became increasingly evident was that the food system is based almost entirely on externalities. So costs that aren't born within the cost of production of the food. And so firstly, massive subsidies at one end and massive health implications and pesticide implications, antibiotic overuse, things that...
I find it amazing the amount of antibiotics that are used in in meat and we consume that.
Yeah, and the risk that poses, it's up there. It's in my top two.
One of the things I've said a few times now on the show is that antibiotic resistance is one of the biggest risks that exists in our world, and that very few people are talking about.
Yes, and it's also spectacularly hard to do anything about. It's not a quick fix solution thing. It's not. We get better at mitigating it and isolating, but
and you're right. There's a negative externality there, because if that risk was kind of costed into the product, then it wouldn't be the market wouldn't be viable for it. But it isn't, so
or everyone needs to include it at once. such okay. that and possibly phase it in over time so they don't get massive consumer backlash and everyone, you know, goes back in riots because they're spending 90% of their income on food. But you need to raise the bar for everybody at once, because one way or another, that's a non-sustainable food system. So you know, reality is going to crash that one day, and that's, you know, we need to fix that. And
there's also this thing about monoculture, you know, agribusiness sort of monoculture, crops being used for one, or soil being used for one crop, depleting nutrients and soils, and we're losing a lot of the topsoil and all of this sort of thing. And there's a parallel with other things in culture, you know, the monoculture, there's, you know, everybody dressing this the same or wanting the same sorts of things, and same life trajectories, and actually we need to kind of shake all of that up and actually embrace the differences in all kinds of aspects of life.
Yes, we've repeated these patterns of sort of
premature, all about economies of scale. So
quite we're prematurely optimizing for the wrong KPIs. Because we've got numbers and because we've put money on these things, and so, and because it's really hard to internalize the externalities, just even in a number way, like even how would you do it, what numbers would you track, how would you make it so that the benefit of tracking them is worth the cost of tracking them, it was traditionally or historically hard. It's getting easier and easier, and tech essentially helps us solve some of that. And there's interesting opportunities for cryptocurrencies to come in and start broadening out the possibilities for fixing that. But it's a big problem. And so then realized, so okay, this isn't going to fix the problem as I wanted it to do. I think I probably left that business too early. I should have tried more things and run more experiments.
I was gonna say now, just as we were talking about, there's a countervailing trend, and I think with particularly with the millennial generation.
Yes and no.
Okay.
Exactly the same phenomena still exists of, you know, like convenience. There are more people. So Farm Drop, which is a fantastic, if you're in London, sign up to Farm Drop. It's a fantastic business that aggregates supplies from local brilliant, you know, high welfare, high responsible farms, producers, and then boxes it up and distributes it, you know, like HelloFresh and these other ones. But it's all brilliantly locally sourced. And so Ben, who started that, started at the same time as I did Food Trade. And, you know, talking with him over the years, it's really hard. And, you know, the pressure on his business and what he has to do to compete. You know, so from that regard, I'm really glad I left. but I'm sort of slightly annoyed I didn't run more experiments and find a different customer need to solve. But, you know, live and learn. But I then went off and started a democracy business.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. What led to that?
So actually about the same time during that sort of existential review of the world, and someone told me, a really good friend called Joseph Davies Coates, who is the most brilliantly broadly knowledgeable man and just full of so many good ideas of how to improve things. He told me about this system called Liquid Democracy. And so Liquid Democracy is essentially you get to choose your own representative or your own representative for different topics. So by default at the moment, we have our MP or our senator or whoever who takes decisions for us. And once every 5 years, we pick between one of three or four colors that are available to us. And they decide everything for us. And that's okay as a default. But, you know, actually, and good job, well done, I really admire the work you're doing. But in health, God, you suck, MP. I do not agree with you in health at all. And I don't understand why, what is so different about my vision that makes it not integrate with your worldview. But one way or another, you want to privatize the shit out of everything, and I want to keep it, you know, essentially public and high performing in public. I don't see why that's a problem. And
But you might agree with a guy on economic policy or foreign policy.
Yeah,
or
everything else, fine. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, take care of that. You're doing a, you know, at least a good enough job on it, and I don't care enough about those other things because they're not quite as essential. So on health, I want to pick a different representative. Mm-hmm. Just on things tagged health as they come through the system. Done. Ooh, actually, maybe education as well. Okay, I'm going to give education to someone else. And so you start distributing power between the people that you trust to make better decisions than the incumbent. It's not to displace the incumbent, because obviously we still have a parliamentary system and they're still in charge, but it's to help a society better surface the intelligence from within the crowd and better allocate trust to where it is, as the crowd determines, can be most usefully deployed. And so actually, it's really like democracy, but it's just what we would do with democracy if we invented it now. So you can have your default, you can be as engaged as you like, and you can have multiple representatives for different things. We didn't do it because the paperwork would have been a nightmare, but now you can do it really easily. And so, cool, that seems like a fun idea. And so, but I couldn't work out a business model for it. And so I left it, I parked it.
As an aside, I mean, it's so interesting because our democratic institutions are actually, they're kind of ancient. And if you think about the US electoral college system, for example, the reason why that exists is because people couldn't get to the same place to vote. So you'd have to get someone on a horse to go and give all the votes to this one place who would then submit them for the presidency. And this is like 300 plus years old.
Yeah, and it's a really good argument for, you know, to point to for the merits of competition, because it's the one domain in which there isn't competition. There's competition within it, as you have parties competing, but they're both playing exactly the same game within the same system, and it's not allowed to evolve. And of course, over time, it gets increasingly corrupted, in quotes, and you know, whether that's active or passive corruption, and just laziness and complacency. Well, we don't need to evolve.
Absolutely. What you're talking about is harder to corrupt, I think, because there are too many nodes. Whereas if you have one representative, then you can kind of, whether it's a lobbyist or whatever, then you can kind of link policies and do all this sort of horse trading over, well, I'll vote for you on this if you, you know.
I'd put a flag in that point and sort of it's, there are ways to game any system. It's possibly just harder to track the corruption that would happen under a liquid democracy system. Probably doesn't mean that we wouldn't try and corrupt it anyway. I mean, there are bad actors all over the place. But one way or another, there's greater transparency and greater potential to fix the problem when it becomes discovered and emerged. And when we fix it, it's not catastrophic. That it's, oh, look, there was one bad actor out of 12 different people making a decision for people in health. We replaced them. Everything carried on fine, rather than, oh, we had a...
So what would that look like in practice? You'd have a representative or representatives for health and then others for education and infrastructure? And
so if we apply it to, you know, say a normal government model, you could go on there, you could run, essentially, you could create a sort of simplified House of Commons. Here is a bill going through Parliament. This is what your MP, or these are the fundamental questions, you know, delivered in plain English, nice and accessible. These are the fundamental questions going on this bill. What do you think about them? If you want to say what you think about them, you can vote and you can participate and you can find out how you compare with everybody else. If you don't, that's okay. Your MP is taking care of it. That's your default. Over time, as you answer more and more of these questions, you then go, oh, actually, on health, we do disagree. You know, we're in the red zone on our agreement. But I can see with this person, I'm in the green zone. So there's an interesting little nuance here that's quite fun to talk about, that you don't actually delegate your vote to anybody. So you don't put pressure on anybody. Like if you suddenly found that you had 200,000 votes for geopolitical issues, like shit, like you might have the deciding vote on whether we do or do not go and bomb whichever country we're bombing today. But what happens is that you copy that person's vote by default instead. So it's still your vote. You still have responsibility for it, but you're just taking their advice. So if we had a conversation in the pub and you said, I think we should do this, I would go home and vote that way anyway. Mm. It's just a way of automating that process. Mm. Right. But it takes the pressure off everybody and also makes it less vulnerable to corruption, mm-hmm. Because that person never actually has your vote in the first place. Mm-hmm. So the... So then what that then looks like is that you, essentially, rather than having, you know, 35 million people going up to 600 representatives in your structural organogram, you have 35 million people going to a couple of hundred thousand people who then in turn probably delegate off their vote to people that they trust who know better. So then you've got 1,000 people. And so within each topic, within each domain. So it's really... like to draw it out and to,
really
and to map
complex.
It, it's really complex.
But we've got the data and the systems to be able to do that.
Yeah, and conceptually it's simple. Mm-hmm. It's just that map it and it gets really complicated. So, yeah, it's a really powerful idea that, again, in theory, should help everybody make better decisions.
So would people have to vote for all these representatives at a certain point?
So... I think there are different ways that you could transition it. The way that I would advocate is that essentially we give that system, let's start with zero executive power for 10 years at least, because, you know, we're a baby with a gun. Like we suddenly learn what power is like and humans being humans, we won't be used to it and we will probably screw something up. But let's, after a couple of years, mm-hmm. introduce common executive power on a couple of really essentially unimportant decisions that don't matter too much if we screw them up. And also let's put sunset clauses on them so they automatically expire after 10 years or something like that. So, you know, let's just be safe and keep the stabilizers on the system. But if you make it so that if I were an MP... MPs are just normal people who get elected, right? They don't know anything about health. They don't know anything about education. They may know an awful lot about, you know, supply chains and businesses and manufacturing, but no idea. Mm. If I had a system that said, hey, here are the 12 people who have credibility within the system and have the trust of 80% of the constituents within your constituency and represent the views of 98% of the constituents within your constituency. If I could get those 12 people into a room and help me make a decision, that's great. Mm-hmm. And so it's way of better harnessing this latent knowledge, this and passion and intelligence and experience that lies dormant within the system, and bring it in to help you as an MP make a better decision. So as an MP, I should be flying if I use this. But getting them to start using it, another story entirely. Mm-hmm. That's a hard sell.
Right.
For all sorts of incredibly good reasons, I might add. I mean, they are doing an insanely hard job with some very odd pressures on them. So... I can see why it annoys me no end that they don't adopt it more readily, but I have every sympathy with why they don't.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened? What was your experience with that business? You said it ran into some...
I started Represent. So Represent, actually this whole liquid democracy thing, a very minor feature of Represent.
I see. Okay.
But it's a really nice goal and driving, you know, world vision. It's like an open version of YouGov or an open polling system. So anyone can ask a question, anyone can answer a question, and then it just does lots of analysis on, and you make it really easy for people to answer those questions. So we were pushing questions out to chatbots and like Facebook Messenger and things. And so a question would just pop up on Facebook Messenger, do you think voting age should be lowered to 16? And then as soon as you answer it, and it's just as easy to answer it as it is to dismiss it. Mm. So people just, answer it. They see how other people have answered it. Oh, that's quite interesting. Cool. And then tomorrow another one comes in and answer that one. And when you think that within your lifetime you have 14 votes in a general election, just 14 opportunities to vote before you die. That's how long you live as an adult. I mean, you know, current politics, we may have 30.
one a year.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. You do that vote in 2 weeks on Represent. So the amount of information about who wants what where and what they're prepared to do about it and how consistent they are on that view as well. Mm. Because you have this ability and people engage so much and want to engage because we want the world to be a good place. We want to share and make these things happen. We are good people struggling against annoying systems. Mm. And getting that information out, you end up with this massive wealth of publicly owned, commonly created resource with which you can drive much better decisions. So by way of comparison, you've got the census that happens every 10 years, costs a fortune, a couple of hundred million each time, and generates information upon which huge infrastructural projects are based.
Now,
and allocation of resources. And so I'll just finish this thought. And it's as the world is getting faster, once every 10 years isn't enough for a census. And so our information is, A, deeply crude, because there are only 50 questions, deeply out of date, and just not keeping pace with contemporary society. And so if you can increase the density and richness of that information, you can go, hey, we've got 700 people in Lewisham who want to join an electric car sharing club, but hey, local authority, there aren't any car sharing, there aren't any parking bays, there aren't any charging points, and your area, your borough, which you have responsibility for air pollution for, you've got 700 people there wanting to sell their cars and help you solve that pollution problem. This is where they live. This is the streets you should put it on. We just save you a ton of research. And then you can take that and you can go to Zipcar and you can say, hey, Zipcar, we've got 700 new customers for you. Give them, 100 quid off each. And boom, there's your business model for a massively engaged civic. Again, the reality is harder.
I was going to just actually ask about, so the whole campaign and process around elections. On the one hand, I can understand the appeal of what you've described. Wouldn't you have others that say, for example, in electoral commissions, well, to have a campaign, you need to have like a set number of weeks and you need to have, sides that register and, pros and cons and, public debates and then let the people decide based on the information. You can't just put, surveys online and get good data.
I'm not sure I have any respect for whatever the electoral commission thinks at the moment. Yeah. Bearing in mind they're the ones who allowed a very, very simple, incredibly poorly run, arguably should be illegal referendum to have happened with this binary choice that there is no intelligent way of answering, because no matter what you did, whether you voted remain, whether you voted leave, or whether you didn't vote, all of those were really stupid answers. And so they were also all really good answers, but they were the electoral commission really doing their job. Plus, incidentally, we have to register to vote.
Yes.
The Americans had a revolution based on this one point. No taxation without representation. Why do I have to register to vote? Yeah. Why are you making it hard for me to vote?
Registration should be automatic with your tax return.
Quite. Right? Get a USB stick, electoral commission, run down to the HMRC, get the data and stick it back on and make pre-validate everybody. This is not a problem. And they're failing in their job. And they spend millions every year pretending, trying to solve this problem and giving grants away to people like Bite the Ballot and these other people who do these amazing campaigns getting young people out there voting. But it's the wrong problem. They're neglecting their responsibility and they haven't modernized. They haven't kept pace with essentially user problems. So, yeah. So, yes, they may think that, but A, they'd be wrong and I don't respect them. And B, they're also wrong in as much as the opinions are being formed every day. Giving that opinion, nothing that we were doing was executive. We weren't saying, you know, vote here and this will happen. Vote here and we will bring back hanging if enough of you say it. Mm. No, we're not going to do that. Mm. What we want to know is how many people would if we did. And let's also test it. And let's ask 10 questions about bringing back hanging or about justice in our society. And what do we actually want? Like, we have this visceral reaction, like, yeah, we need stronger punishment. But why and to what ends? And so we can better triangulate where people are at and help people understand for themselves where they're at by asking questions. It's this sort of dialectic of surfacing better information by layering on questions. And so we come to a better understanding of what we're actually getting at. And then you can start to think about what solutions you might apply to that. So if you can identify, oh, there is a visceral desire to you know, we have this sense of injustice. Well, is that because we just don't know how the justice system works? Is that because crime is overreported and so on and so on?
Well, if you look at what's happened here with Brexit, arguably the last two and a half years have been an education process in how the EU and international trade barriers work and all of this sort of stuff that people didn't understand at all when they voted or didn't vote. Arguably they stayed away, particularly young people, because young people don't vote as much, and maybe this is part of the problem.
Yeah. And I think the slightly malicious and annoying thing is that actually it's also by design. And I don't mean to be sort of conspiratorial about it, but essentially if you can pay tax by default and are auto enrolled on that, and you aren't auto enrolled on voting registration, like that in itself is enough to go, yeah, you're not actually trying. Plus, then, you know, none of the main parties in the UK are in favour of proportional representation. And so you're saying that you don't think my vote should count. Great. Okay, fine. You know, I'm not just on those two principles. I can see how you might think that increases stability, but the signal that it sends to your population, that's not cool, guys. That's really not cool, especially when, you know, essentially a lot more of us are a lot more educated than a lot of you and have spent more time working in these areas that we care passionately about. So it's not only neglecting to use and make use of a very good resource, it's also belittling that resource. So yeah, and that is why I started Represent, because we can do better than this, and we deserve better than this. And if we don't do better than this, guess what? We're going to trend towards authoritarian binaries. Yeah, exactly. And so, I'm sorry I didn't start it sooner.
No, it's fascinating because on the one hand, people say, well, democracy is in retreat and authoritarianism is on the rise. Well, what you're saying is, yeah, and we're the ones causing democracy to retreat because we haven't kept pace with how society works.
Who's the we in that sentence?
Our societies, our governments.
Yes.
The people who represent us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or don't, as the case.
And I suppose to a certain extent we've allowed it to happen. But if you look at the feasible choices that we have, no one is offering a better solution. So we simply do not have the mechanism to vote for the solution that we want. And so therefore, you know, if the choices are being curated for us, if neither of the main parties are going to suggest a better solution because it's in their interest not to, then it's up to the citizens to pause and to, you know, say, hang on a second, government, you know, let's go back to Magna Carta sort of, and, you know, and it happens every 400 years or so. We have to basically just kick the machinery of government and go, okay, you've gone too far off the rails now. Let's pick it back up. Set it back on the rails and maybe tweak its direction and change a few things so that doesn't happen, and just restore it. But that is an incredibly bold move that we don't really know how to do nor have the means for in contemporary society.
If anything, we were less and less happy with. We want. It's very uncomfortable, as we just talked about. It's very disruptive, but we're being disrupted anyway.
Yeah. Leaving the status quo is infinitely more disruptive than actually pausing and dealing with the issue. But unfortunately, what it looks like when we try and sort of deal with the issue is gilets jaunes and yeah, I get it, but it's not massively constructive. And so, yeah, we need better ways of doing that. Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So there's I really want a party to stand, to come up and say, we are going to stand for one election. During that one election, we are going to fix these low-hanging fruit and easy loopholes that everyone can agree on in democracy. We're going to make it so that you can't lie in a referendum. Mm-hmm. We're going to make it so that every referendum has, you know, threshold points and at least three options on it. We're going to possibly make it so that every referendum has, you know, it has to be phased over time. So we have education periods and vote and choice periods and then voting periods and sunset periods. We are going to make it so that we bring in proportional representation and default voter registration. And then after, you know, whatever the minimal time is we can get that done in, we are going to disband, and then you can go back to having your Conservatives and your Labours and your Lib Dems and whoever's and your SNPs and your Greens. Like, crack on, because we just need to improve this system for everyone. We've got giant loopholes which are screwing over everybody, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum. And so, yeah, I think that would be a good party.
Yeah, it would be. And I think the US needs this. Mm-hmm. Desperately.
Yeah.
That system feels totally broken. Mm. And then you've got, you know, the likes of Putin and others taking pot shots at, you know, well, look at what's happening in the US, you know, opioid crisis or mm-hmm. whatever. Their democracy doesn't work. Mm. Look at what's happening in Europe. Look at what's happening in Britain. Democracy doesn't work, guys.
And to a certain extent, it is just a function of... Countries with proportional representation also suffer similar problems, but the first-past-the-post voting system definitely exacerbates these problems. And there are, you know, only a handful of countries that still have it. It's so dysfunctional. Yeah. There's a very good organization called Make Votes Matter, which is a PR campaign organization, proportional representation campaign organization. And they've been doing some great work on pushing this. And, yeah, check them out. And they've also got some really nice videos on... just to highlight and demonstrate the maths of why first past the post goes wrong over time.
Mm. Yeah, Canada has the same system as well, and similar debates, but less explosive than than here. I did want to talk a little bit more about represent.
Yes,
and what it's there or what's meant to achieve, what your experience has been with it. And what you've learned.
So it's been fantastic, and I've learned a lot. Arguably not enough or soon enough, but you know, that's life. We had really high engagement. You know, people want to participate.
And just for what was it? How would you explain it to somebody who?
What was represent?
Yes, or what is it?
It represent is still online at represent.me. Yes. It's the servers are running. It's 99% functional. Don't try and log in with Facebook. They changed the rules, and which is good. But I'm not pushing it at the moment because I'm trying to pivot the business model behind it and come up with both a better business model and a better business structure that reflects that. So it's there, your data won't be lost. But you know, essentially I needed to pay bills and our plan A wasn't working. And so I'm not one of these people who can look someone in the eye and go, hello, can I have lots of money, please? I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I'm going to sort of experiment. And I like having the answer and knowing that even though I may be massively wrong, at least I know what I'm going to do and why I think it's going to work, rather than I screwed up and I'm in a bit of a hole at the moment. Can I have some money to keep this going? It's not, you know. So it's a civic-centric voting platform that increases public participation in decisions. It works at any scale and for any size of organization. So you can have groups in there and private groups. And so you can, you know, if you're my netball team can vote on something or other, my
netball
union
facilities and
my union can vote on something. Or one of the opportunities that we're exploring at the moment is in pensions and occupational pensions, and so members of this pension scheme can vote on something. And it's all of the data is open. It's obviously anonymized, and so, you know, identity is protected, and we were first on the GDPR thing. Like, it's definitely, we are pro civic, we are pro user rights, but we are also pro maximizing the effect of the information that you put into it, so that when you vote, we do our best to make sure that your MP, your local authority, or your group leader or whoever sees that information and has the, essentially everything that they need to understand who is participating, where they're participating, whether it's representative, and mine into the data. But as so can anybody can interrogate it, and we've got APIs, so you can build stuff off the back of it as well. There's someone doing something actually with Brexit at the moment, building various sort of campaign style tools and informational tools on it. So it's there and it's working. But the what I was hoping was that MPs and political parties would essentially see the innate genius in the system, go and embrace it, and then give us some money for it. And if they didn't, Parliament would, and if they didn't, local authorities would. And local authorities, I think, would have done, but, you know, essentially local authorities are under stress, and they don't really want, I sound so cynical, but it's sort of through proof that they don't really massively want public participation in decisions, because then it slows them down and makes them more expensive, and they're just trying to get that school built, and the longer we wait, the longer we don't have a school, and the harder it gets, and the more expensive it gets, and So none of the clients that I wanted to have as clients wanted to be clients, which is like such a stupid error. But what I wanted to make sure of was that our values kept on being met, that we were a civic centric for the people, a political tool that was strong on open data. We could get parties interested in adopting it if they could close the data. If they and they alone had view of the data.
Yeah, of course.
That's not the point. Yeah, that's not how democracy works. Well,
their incentives are almost at odds with what you're trying to do.
Unfortunately, well, their short-term incentives are. Yes. Their long-term incentives aren't. But getting politicians to think in terms of the long-term is hard.
So what's the pivot?
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
It's kind of exciting. In that regard, maybe I should tell you, I haven't locked it down yet, and I want to. But essentially,
I would have thought that somebody who wants to be a disruptor would be very interested in this.
Yes,
the I don't know, the Elon Musk of democracy or something.
Yes, interestingly,
whoever that is.
So, a lot of people are. There are lots of people who are excited about funding projects in democracy, but they tend to want to fund partisan projects in democracy. They don't want to improve the game. They want to improve their outcome. Mm. And their outcome may be the benignest outcome in the world, right? But nonetheless, they want campaign tech, not democracy tech. Mm. And help me win, not help help the other guy win, potentially. And so that's a challenge. But... And so it's how do you keep it civic-centric? And
you almost need to get all of the major participants or people from different sides to kind of agree to fund, but that's hard.
Well, yeah. So what we're doing is making it so that there's a lot more in it for the individual citizen, the individual, so that we're... essentially gamifying it more and applying a bit more of a lottery model to it, so that it's more fun and rewarding to participate in. But that also multiplies up the impact in a really clever way. And so there's definitely a good idea in there, but having thought I've had good ideas before, I'm being wary and testing this one quite thoroughly before essentially committing myself to another 3 years of pushing a very heavy rock up a very steep hill.
Well, that makes that sounds pretty sensible. The other thought I had is people who invest in these kinds of things sometimes, you know, I think they invest in people rather than just the tool or the idea.
So this is a great lesson. actually. I think I didn't really appreciate that going in, and that the people who invest in them are ready to, you know, they understand what a risk it is, and they're very compassionate and generous with that understanding. If you know how to use it, and I never really realized it, and so I essentially felt a lot of shame for failure in the last few years. And
you shouldn't, because you're trying to revolutionize. You know, it's like I didn't change the system.
I'm sorry, save the world.
Didn't save the world. So yeah. I feel it's easy to.
Yeah, I was trying to get a better Brexit, but I couldn't.
Single-handedly, yes.
And yes, but nonetheless, you know, that when you're close to something and it's your project and
I think these are the hard things with sort of passion projects. And we were talking before we went on air about some types of small businesses that are just the luxury dog food or whatever that's a product, and the point is to make as much money as possible, and if it doesn't, then I'll pivot to something that makes more money. But when we're attached to the project, it's harder to let go of the ideas.
And it's also harder to see the genuine problems as well. Like it's massively frustrating, but it does seem to be a real case that we have, as individuals, we have identified problems and unidentified problems, and we'll pay to solve the identified problems. If we know we've got a problem, we will, you know, one way or another, pay money to make it go away or do something to make it go away. But if there's something that society needs, that is a commons problem that is shared by everybody, and it's not our own individual responsibility to fix it, we know it's there. We know, you know, it's annoying, but it's not really my problem. And so there's ultimately, end of the day, there's just not a business model in it. There might be a philanthropic model in it. There might be other tangential business models in it. You get them engaged, you make money off something else, and you cross-subsidize. But there's not a direct, hey, world, do you want a better democracy? Yeah, well, we're going to have to fund it model in there, because not enough people want to do that. You know, you look at Wikipedia, possibly humanity's finest accomplishment. Right. I mean, it's amazing the amount of information, the amount of knowledge that's been aggregated into that. And they struggle for funding. That's wrong. Like, that's just, it just bewilders me every time I mention this. But nonetheless, that's the reality. And we've got to play the cards we've been dealt. And that's what we've got to deal with as entrepreneurs, as people trying to change the system. It's all with the consent of everybody else. And you can only do things if you've got people willing to back it with their attention and their time. And if you can't do that, with their attention, their time, and their attention, their money, basically. And if you can't do that, you haven't got a business. And it annoys me, because so many of the problems that we need to solve in this 21st century are those sort of problems. They don't have business models. They have, you know, we can help avert costs, but those are future costs which will be borne by other people, not our own costs now. And so I can't remember, it was before we were recording, I think, but talking about externalities, because we've not worked out how to financialize externalities effectively. We don't have incentive mechanisms to get people involved in solving those types of problems, and that's a massive problem for our society and also for our economy, because we're sort of building this massive bubble, this massive debt.
All those big problems, the plastics in our ocean, the antibiotic resistance, climate change, all of those things are arguably because of these externalities.
Yeah, and civilization is just building up this debt, which will one day come back and bite us. And
do you think philosophically it comes down to sort of collectivist versus individualistic type of societies? Do we need to become a little bit more, I don't know, community orientated?
I think yes, but there's also quite a wide gap between the sort of egalitarian communism and, you know, sort of
Right, I wasn't saying, on I wasn't necessarily...
No, I do appreciate that, you use the word collectivism rather than communism, but just to point out the scale, you know, through to rabid individualism on the other
end. <any stretch. clears
throat> But I think there's something that we've lost, and is this the commons...
Yes.
And so that which no one owns and everybody owns, that which is everyone's problem and no one's problem. Mm. And you know, by which I mean like fresh air or public health or fresh water and the things that that keep us alive, the shade of that tree, you know, is a lovely thing, but it's not anyone's real problem to fix or do. And though I think also there, because it's been so neglected for such a long time, it used to be kind of taken care of by religion and also by more liquid societies, i.e. they didn't really move very much. Like now we're quite atomized, we're quite gaseous as a society. Mm. You know, people stay in one place for 8 months and then they move and they get another flat and they move to city and, you know. And you didn't have that. And so people may have paid more attention and invested more in their local community. But I think... And there was the church that took care of protecting individuals and creating holy days that, you know, obviously then become holidays. And then you got the emergence of unions. Mm-hmm. And I think unions played a really interesting role back in the early day before they sort of became self-interested and narcissistic and and selfish and annoying, as many of them are now. Not to say they don't do good stuff, but fundamentally not a good track record, guys. But how they started was fantastic, because it was here is a problem that we as a community, we as individuals within this community are experiencing. Business has no incentive to fix it. Government has no incentive to fix it. And therefore, we're kind of on our own. What do we do? And so they started mutual funds and mutual aid societies. And then they started saying, well, hang on, we've got this. If we all don't go to work tomorrow, we can actually have an effect. Mm-hmm. And it's that where it's that how civic society, we were talking earlier about how do we pause it, fix it for everybody, and then allow it to move on. I think that space around the commons, sort of like a modern union, is a really effective way of dealing with that and applying collective pressure. There's an interesting aspect of that as well, which is that depending on the progress of AI and automation and robotics and whatnot, we only have a limited window through which to do that. Because everyone that goes on strike now, that people say, well, bring in the machines, you know, automate it. And that's to a certain extent, that's a brilliant answer. But that's only a great answer if you're on strike because you want more pay. Whereas if you're on strike because, hey, this world isn't working for anybody, not even the machines, you've got a much better point. But you've only got 10 years until, you know, essentially humans are becoming increasingly replaceable and withholding labor ceases to be a useful lever. But I fully expect to see a lot of innovation in the common space, in the mutual space. And because, you know, for example, if you look at what our pensions are invested in, I think we sort of think that capitalism and corporates are a different thing. We own those. That's our pension funds. Every investment that you've got goes into that. So it's our choice. It's our money that is shaping the future of capitalism. And we can choose, unfortunately, again, made really hard to choose, but we can exercise discretion about which pension funds we join. We can choose to join a high impact pension. We can choose to divest and pull all of our money out of fossil fuels. We can choose to invest in the businesses that have that share our values. If you look at most pension funds, like you would be mortified to find out what, you know, most people who are auto-enrolled, they're in the default pension. If you look at what it's invested in, if you can even find out what it's invested in, you're doing well. But then you review it, and it's like, that's not cool. I did not want to be invested in weapons and oil and massive banks. I want to be invested in, you know, world-saving biotech and renewable engineering. I want to be renewable energy. I want to be invested in the stuff that's going to do a hockey stick curve in the next 10 years, because that's what we need. And we're not doing that. And so I think that collective responsibility, so you're right, collectivism, and that idea of, oh, oh, it's ours. We can do that. And that reintegration, as the pendulum swings back from the atomization, I think, yeah, I'm incredibly optimistic about that space mm-hmm. as a realm for innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so interesting. The other thought I had is, through all of this sort of voting data, it, as you use the words open source, mm-hmm. I think that's great because data is the new oil, as people have been talking about, and actually Google and Facebook, and they've got these massive deposits of data that we don't own, mm-hmm. that we've voluntarily given away, that, as we know, have been used for various nefarious purposes. And if we find a way to get control of that again, our political opinions, then that's power.
So you're skirting back towards the new business model for Represent, that essentially, if we do this as individuals, I should be paid for my data. Well, here's £4. Enjoy paying for the internet for the rest of the year. And we'll give you maybe £5 next year. It's not worth it.
It's not worth it. No.
But if we do it collectively,
it's huge.
Like, that's the entire business model of the internet. So if we do that collectively, there's shitloads of money there. We can really empower there, and we can really do things if we can just organize to do it ourselves. And it has to be an enlightened way, not in a kind of, hey, everybody get together and share. Like, it's going to be mercenary businesses, mm-hmm. but they're going to be beneficial corporations. They're going to be cooperatives, things that are owned by and run for the interest of their members, and that is in their charter. The idea that, there's a new Airbnb starting up that is owned and run by the members. Similarly, countries that don't have Uber or any ride sharing yet, there are open source taxi sharing systems, car sharing systems out there. If you're in Slovenia right now, download one, start one up, and run a commons one and nail it before Uber gets in. Because as soon as they get in, they're going to have a lot more money to spend on marketing and a lot more brand awareness. But if you can start up, Slovenia cab, right, done. And so there's, this space of recognizing that essentially we humans need to, as decoupled as large numbers of people who aren't in that 1% and or in that 0.1% and aren't wedded to the idea of corporate efficiency and economic efficiency being the sole arbiter of good, and who want to create these multipliers in our society and who want healthier distributed jobs and more sense of fairness and opportunities. That collectivism, cooperativism, mutualism, that in the commons, that space is hopefully, fingers crossed, going to flourish. I mean, it's been increasing a lot.
It's also more libertarian as well. There's more competition, but fair competition. The FANG, Facebook, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, and Google. Just again, the amount of data that's concentrated in those four businesses, those huge businesses.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and I suppose with that come there's a part of me that wants to talk in defense of them, and just that. A lot of those who have great power also are exercising a lot of great responsibility with that power.
Sure.
But the compromises that they make in order to keep some of those things rolling are perhaps not where we would go. And I think that greater participation within, essentially greater participation within decisions tends to lead to better outcomes because you've got more people affected by the impacts of those decisions who have a voice and stand up and help you correct for those problems before they become problems. And so you end up with a better system. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think you can rely on people. We're much better at agreeing what we're against rather than what we're for, and much better at organizing around what we're against rather than what we're for, which is, I think, fantastic, because it keeps us out of doing the really stupid, dangerous, selfish stuff, and doesn't dictate how the future should be and how you should live, and it doesn't get sort of it doesn't get commandy, but it does stop us being really stupid and annoying and essentially destroying ourselves often. So that's nice. Mm. We can often be a little bit unpragmatic, and we need to have our hand held as we make public decisions. Like I was saying, if you were going to institute a collective parliament, that it shouldn't have any executive power for at least 10 years. Let's be pragmatic and let's phase it as we withdraw from these fossil fuels, or otherwise we will collapse everybody's pensions and screw over every pensioner in the world. But let's definitely do it, and let's accelerate it, but let's do it sensibly and intelligently and wisely. And, allowing people to choose non-directions of travel is, I think, we're just so often failing to harness that,
it's very powerful. Mm. I don't know if you've read Skin in the Game by Taleb. I don't know if we're going to need to.
I've not read it yet, mm-hmm. but understand the concept.
There's a thing also about the power of the minority.
Actually, I think I read The Blinkist on it.
Right, yeah. Right. And he talks about, so for example, kosher foods, mm-hmm. and so in there are so many things that are actually kosher because mm-hmm. foodstuffs, because if you eat kosher foods, then it has to be that way. But if you don't, then you could still accept that.
Yeah.
So through certain things, by having these sort of, I think it's called via negativa is what he calls it, by having these things that we won't do, but that are acceptable to many people, then the sort of power of this via negativa works, mm-hmm. the sort of power of the minor. So if we don't, invest in weapons or dangerous plastics, and we can make choices that don't hurt people.
Yeah.
If you avoid those things, then slowly that becomes that becomes the default.
Yes. We experimented quite a lot on represent with that negative kind of decision making. Mm-hmm. What do you find unacceptable? Mm-hmm. And working it from that way, rather than what do you want? What is the desirable thing here? Which is your favorite? It's where's your red line? Mm. What won't you accept? Mm. And that's a much more powerful way of surfacing consensus quickly and getting everybody through. Because if you do it that way, the chances of uniting everybody are a lot greater. Mm. And the chances are that the minority who doesn't agree with you on that one is, essentially going to feel enough pressure I know you're invested in fossil fuels and I know you want your investment, but actually we shouldn't be doing that. Or, hey, CEO, you're the only person who's getting 120x the average wage in this company, so I'm afraid you're going to have to rein that in a little bit. It's a very effective way of making decisions.
I think it's fascinating. I think what you're doing is absolutely fascinating, and we desperately need it as a society. We've been going for a while, so I think we're going to need to wrap it up soon, but was there anything that we didn't get a chance to cover that you wanted to mention?
No, I think we've covered off a lot of things. I'm sure I could have made this considerably more useful in thinking of sort of lessons I've learned on my journey.
This is all great, and
helped you, dear listener, this is great. Get more out of this. But I've certainly enjoyed the conversation.
I think everyone who's listening will enjoy it. Will have enjoyed it. Before we go, where can people find you? Where can they find Represent?
My name is Ed Dowding, and I'm Ed Dowding on pretty much everything. And Represent is at represent.me, and I think
people be following represent.me for changes in
why not
pivot
and so like represent this. Me is the domain name, and at represent live is the Twitter and Facebook. But definitely, by all means, follow. Perhaps be a little bit patient for a while. Having to pay bills is time-consuming and doesn't allow a lot of time for development. But I'm hoping that this year we'll see quite a lot of big changes. And also, essentially the political climate it's done its chaos period. And I think we're sort of I was going to say, I think we're over chaos now. No, we're not. But we're getting out of, we're getting more solution focused. Mm-hmm. And there's more innovation, more viable innovation creeping up, and a greater appetite for that. Mm-hmm. So I'm expecting an exciting year. So yes, but please do follow us. Perhaps follow me at Ed Dowding on Twitter or whatever. And whatever way it goes, you'll find out there.
That's great. That's wonderful.
Just I would also say, follow All Things Risk as well.
Yeah, of course.
You do not have enough followers.
This is great content, and it needs to see the world. Yeah,
yeah.
I need more. But also to listeners, I would say if you have any ideas for you to for Ed, just go and let you know, because I'm sure there are several.
Yes. Yeah. I'm always up for meeting people either with interesting ideas themselves who want help, or especially if you're interested in the civic tech space and one way or another want to make the world a better place. Yeah, by all means, get in touch, especially if you're a venture capitalist. Or in fact, a venture communist. Let's give it that one. Venture commonsist.
Venture commonsist.
If you've got lots of money and you would like to give it to us, or if you've got lots of talent and you would like to bring it to bear on this problem, by all means, please do get in touch.
That's fabulous. And just as an aside on the whole, I do think we're kind of coming through the other end of certain aspects of the chaos. And I think I was told, there was an opinion that I think is valid, I like to think is true, is that fake news is going to become a little bit more like spam, and that mm-hmm. you'll be able to spot it a little bit more. And just like spam was a problem in the internet, the early days of the internet 20 years ago, it's less of a problem.
I don't know. I hope so. I think there's a slightly generational thing that younger people are better at spotting fake news and we share it less. But fake news is also weaponizing. Mm-hmm. You've got deep fakes, you've got lots of the internet is a massive ecosystem and there are lots of niches to fill, and in those niches thrive all sorts of interesting and novel inventions, which will often be cancerous, for want of a slightly better word, or at least have the potential to do harm. And yeah, definitely fact check stuff, but I sort of wonder about fake news, how much of a problem it actually is. Mm-hmm. Like fake news in the American election, did that get Trump elected, or was Hillary just a shit candidate? Ultimately, if you're not going to put up, if it comes down to fake news, and if it's that close on the election, you probably didn't try hard enough in getting the right person to the public fair arena enough. In the first place, fair right? Enough. So if fake news, to a certain extent, is a sort of Darwinian force that that requires of us to up our game and requires of us to build better things that people know are working. Mm. That this is a massive, fun, exciting project that everyone can get enthused by, and this is happening and we're all part of it. And that sense of a society making meaningful progress, if we can work on that stuff, I think the noise of fake news goes away that much more, because it becomes much less significant, because we're not trying to fight each other. We've all got a common purpose, or reasonably shared purpose that we can work towards, that is worth working towards. Whereas if it's a massive bipartisan fight between A and B, or country A and B, then fake news helps that war. But if everybody opts out of that war and goes and builds some cool stuff instead, then the war just whatever, play the game if you want, but we're over here saving the world. So I could of course be wrong.
Well, I think it gives us a good sort of positive note to end on.
Yes.
So Ed, thank you very much for your time. This was brilliant. I enjoyed it a lot.
Been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll talk soon.
Yes. Thanks and again. Follow All Things Risk.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you. I hope you found that thought-provoking. Check out Ed. Links are in the show notes as usual. And of course,
let us know what you thought about anything you heard today. Leave a comment on social media or just drop me a note, allthingsrisk@gmail.com. Of course, don't forget to subscribe to the show, allthingsrisk.co.uk. That's .co.uk. We will be back in 2 weeks. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.